Our next guest on the Ready, Set, Change podcast is Tim Sackett. Tim is an HR leader, and he is president of HRU Technical Staffing Solutions. Tim's also a prolific blogger, and has been working at the Tim Sackett Project for a number of years, and it's read by hundreds of thousands of HR leaders across the globe. Tim's also the author of The Talent Fix and an expert at talent acquisition. So I'm really excited to talk with Tim today about change management, how to be ready to change, and how to find the right people to do the job. So welcome, Tim Sackett, to the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm really excited to talk with you today because I feel like we are connected in many ways.
Yeah.
First met each other about 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and you have just skyrocketed with your career as a blog writer. I've seen your Tim Sackett Project for years, and I've read many, many of your blog posts, and now you have your book released through Sherm.
Yeah.
And, you know, what else is going on in your world?
You know, it's funny. I never set out to be a writer. I didn't even know if I could write. So it's one of those things that's it's very rewarding. I've had a lot of fun doing it, but like I run... You know, HRU, it's, you know, we do the staffing thing day in and day out, and that's the full-time job. But, you know, it's a crazy thing happens when you start writing on the internet and you blog for 10 years is that people think you know what you're talking about, whether you do or don't. And you start to find an audience and it gets bigger. And so, again, my wife likes to tease that I have two full-time jobs. So I do the writing and speaking, but I also run a company.
Wow. Well, that is two full-time jobs, and it sounds like you had mentioned also that you have a Hall of Fame wife, and tell me what she's in the Hall of Fame for.
She was NCAA Volleyball Player of the Year finalist, and then her team that she played with at the University of Wyoming ended up being in the Hall of Fame for their accomplishments, and so people always like when I say that when I'm speaking, they'll say, oh, is it, he's a sweet husband, he calls his wife Hall of Fame wife, and I'm like, well, no, she really is in the Hall of Fame.
That's awesome. So when you first started the Tim Sackett Project, which is your blog, tell me, what was your goal and what were you, you know, because I've really enjoyed your postings over the year, but what was your goal to start out with? Because I thought, you know, the nice thing about your blog is it just has a great conversational tone.
You know, I never meant it. When you first start blogging, what you realize is like you're talking to nobody. Like anybody can put a blog up on the internet and, and unless you tell somebody or someone finds it and or sharing socially or whatever, like the audience is super small. And so ideally when I first started, it was like therapy. Instead of going and paying $150 an hour to sit with a therapist, all the stuff in my head, I would just write about and get out there. And what you first find too, when you first start writing like a blog, like I did, it started out kind of HR talent acquisition. It's kind of morphed into all of leadership at this point, but it's still a lot of talent acquisition technology. You know, I write about anything I want, which is nice. But when you first start writing, everybody that reads is a fan. So there's all this affirmation that's coming back in a very positive way, which is awesome. And then as the audience starts to grow and grow and grow, then all the haters and kind of trolls come out. And so you realize like not everybody's a fan, but that takes some time. But originally it was literally like, you know, you go and you work and you're in these corporate jobs and political stuff happens and you're frustrated. And so I was just like, I just started blogging. And the crazy part was like, I didn't even care if like whoever I was working with actually saw it or found it, but I knew they wouldn't. Like I just had this feeling like no one's reading HR blogs a decade ago. Like who's going to find this thing? And so like I read some of the stuff that I wrote like 7 years ago, and it's so raw and so real and so kind of emotional and passionate. And so I'm envious of that person writing because now if I wrote half that stuff, I would just get killed, you know, so.
Well, and tell me a little bit about what you've seen over the last, you know, decade in terms of change with HR roles and with, you know, how we go about looking for talent and bringing people into to our work environments. I mean, I think it's one of those things, isn't it, that has really evolved over the last decade. And I've seen a lot of changes that, you know, when you look at them incrementally, you don't really see them. But when you see it over kind of a longer term, you say, wow, things have changed substantially, I think, in the world of HR.
Oh, it's insane. The speed and the amount of change that's taken place in the last decade is crazy. And I think one of the things that we forget to put into this equation, especially when it comes to talent acquisition, and if you're a hiring manager, we forget that what the recession did, right? So for about 8-year period, we didn't really have to hire. We didn't really have to attract talent. I mean, if you put a job opening up, hundreds, thousands of people were applying, like everybody was desperate. At the same time, the talent that you had didn't leave because they were afraid if they left, that maybe the new job wouldn't be as good. Maybe they would lose it. Maybe there was no jobs for them to go to. And so we've totally forgotten that for almost a decade, we didn't train ourselves on how to be really good at talent acquisition, how to recruit. We put no money into it, into the technology, into our own development as talent acquisition professionals. We literally did nothing. And so, you know, we basically, all you had to do was kind of post a job and pray somebody applied. And you didn't have to pray very hard because all kinds of people applied. And then, you know, about 8 years ago, that all kind of turned around and we came out of the recession and people had to play catch up. And it's been a decade of playing catch up. And I think hiring managers take for granted that fact. If you've been in a hiring manager for a long time, you go, oh, well, why can't you just put the job up? And why aren't you getting us talent? And you go, all of a sudden, all at the same time, all these jobs opened up. By the same token, demographics were playing against us because we had the baby boomers now leaving, right? Their retirement accounts came back and it became very easy for them to kind of say, okay, I'm out. I hung on during the recession and now I'm getting out of here. And so you had those three things kind of play together. You had lack of investment, lack of development, demographics playing against us. And all of a sudden now, you know, you have hiring managers that think they should just be able to look at 10, 20, 100 candidates at a time that are all qualified. And you're like, no, like there's a lack of talent. We have a lack of like sophistication on the talent acquisition side. And so in the last like 8 to 10 years, what I've seen is like this rush to catch up. So a rush to catch up via technology, a rush to catch up via development. And, you know, little by little, I think companies are getting there, but it's taken a lot of time to do that.
So in your experience and kind of in what you're seeing in HR, because I know that you have so many contacts in HR also, when you're talking about, you know, trying to do this catch up on talent acquisition and recognizing that, you know, there's more openings than there are people who qualify for those openings now. Can you tell me a little bit about how measurement plays a factor in that? Because I think one of the chapters in your book talks about measurement. And when it comes to change, I find that, you know, if we're not measuring something, it's not getting attention. So, you know, how do you incorporate measurement to make sure that you're, you know, finding the right people or that you're actually fulfilling the roles that you need to and getting your company set in a strategic direction?
Yeah, I'm a little crazy when it comes to data and analytics in terms of measuring performance, not only for my team, but individually, but also as a team, you know, and across the board. And I think when I take a look at it from a talent acquisition perspective, from a corporate perspective, you know, I'm going to definitely put measures on individuals. I'm going to say, hey, here's the goal. Here's the measure. I know what the baseline is. And, you know, hey, this is an easy way to performance management. I think that's one of the biggest ways leaders fail in performance management is they're doing it still by gut. They're doing it by feel. Well, you know, Mary's just, you know, better than you, you know, at this. And you're like, well, how? Show me how. How is Mary better? Why is Mary better? Or are you just better friends with Mary and you like her personality better than mine? Which again, plays into performance, but I mean, you better have like a really clear picture of why that is. And in talent acquisition side, like we know it's pretty much a sales funnel kind of thing. I need to know how many candidates are coming in the funnel, how many my recruiters are screening. From there, how many are they sending to a hiring manager? And the hiring manager goes, hey, you sent me 10 candidates and I want to interview all 10. That's a great quality of candidate. Or if they come back and say, I only want to interview one, I know I have a problem with the quality that my recruiters are sending to that hiring manager. And then after they interview, how many are they actually making offers to? And like, you can see a very clear picture of the success of a recruiter based on that funnel. And it's a simple sales funnel. And then I always like, you know, people always like, oh, well, Tim, you know, quality of hire is super important. And I'm like, yeah, it is, except that's not a talent acquisition measure. Quality of hire is a hiring manager measure. I mean, they're the ones making the selection. So if they're hiring people and they're saying, yep, I want to hire Tim, and Tim's a garbage candidate or ends up being a garbage employee, that's not on talent acquisition because the hiring manager was the one that made the decision. And my, so my pushback, and they'll say, well, that was the best, you know, person that, you know, that was available. That's the only one that they gave me that was even close. I'm like, well, then you're lowering your expectations. That's a leader, and you should push back and say, no, I'm not going to hire any of these people. You need to go and do a better job. Or again, how does that happen? One of the questions I ask in my book, and it's really the organizations that I look at that have the most success at talent acquisition, the thing that they do the best is they ask this question, which is, who owns talent acquisition in the organization? And if they come back and say it's recruiting or it's talent acquisition or it's HR, they've already failed, because they, those people do not make the selection of the talent. It's the leader that makes the selection. And so I always push back on leaders to say, you should want to own your own team. Like, if I, any team I've ever ran in any company I've ever run, or worked in as a leader, and I had a team that reported to me, I never allowed HR or talent acquisition to dictate the talent on my team. I was going to be the one that dictated that. I was going to go find great talent. I was going to surround myself with great talent. And I owned that. And they're like, well, yeah, but you have talent attraction and HR background, so you have the ability to do that. I'm like, no, everybody has that ability. If your entire recruiting team got killed in a bus crash tomorrow, got hit by a train, you're still going to be held responsible to fill your positions and make the work get done in your team as a leader. And so I think it's critical that we do that. And then go, once you own it, now the recruiting team, the HR team can really support you and help you find great talent. But somebody has to own it. I still push back on the leaders on that.
I really like that perspective, because I feel like it's very relevant to change management, in the sense that, you know, many times change management professionals who are involved in a project are held responsible for the role that the leader needs to play, which is to promote that change to, mm-hmm. you know, to their team, and to make sure that they're active and visible with the change. And, you know, it's not necessarily something that change management practitioner can do, you know, to be active and visible for the sponsor. And it sounds like you're saying something very, very similar, that the leader needs to be responsible for their team and for the choices they make in terms of hiring, as opposed to the talent acquisition team being responsible for their team. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a classic psychology example, right? Where if 100 people see a house on fire, they'll all kind of watch the house burn down. If one person sees a house on fire, they do whatever they can to stop the house from being on fire. A traffic accident, whatever you see, think of yourself going on your normal commute. It's in the morning, there's thousands of cars. You see a car off to the side, and every single person will drive by and not stop and help. If you're like in your neighborhood and there's nobody around, there's one car on a side street pulled over, and you can see that there's a problem, you're going to stop and help. And that's the ownership dilemma, right? When you think everybody owns it, because that's the pushback I'll get from executives. Well, Tim, everybody here owns talent acquisition. And I'm like, no, that means nobody owns it. I mean, that's literally the case. Because nobody will take responsibility and say, oh yeah, I actually own the talent on my team. I'm going to make sure it happens. I don't care. I would love your help, HR and talent acquisition. Please help me. But if you don't, it doesn't matter. I'm still going to do what I have to do to get the talent I need.
So in your book, The Talent Fix, how do you, I really like the way it was laid out. And you had some strategies and ideas to help leaders think about, you know, how to shift this. Can you give us some examples of ways leaders can, you know, fix this and do a better job of making sure that they're kind of taking that ownership?
Yeah, I mean, I came up with the design based on, I talked to a lot of like CHROs and CEOs, and the conversation's always this, like, you know, we suck at recruiting. Our recruiting's broken. You know, could you come and fix it, right? What would you do to fix it? And again, that answer could be a million different things, because it depends on, you know, that team, that organization, that market, like everything. And so I said, like, how do I really help a lot of people with that answer? And so I said, okay, what if they said, hey, we want you to come in and run our talent acquisition? What would you do differently than how we do it now? And so that's kind of how I started and wrote the book, right? So day one, and I even started at the interview, and challenge people to say, hey, if you're going to go run talent acquisition or recruiting for a company, here's what you should be asking in the interview before you put yourself in an awful situation. Because so many people say they want to fix it, but they don't really want to fix it. They want you to fix it, but they don't want the organization to fix it. And it's an organizational issue, right? It's not necessarily a one person or a one team issue. And then, you know, and then kind of build from there and talk about the team dynamics, what kind of people. What I find is most corporate talent acquisition professionals are great people, well-meaning people, smart people, very professional, but they don't want to recruit. They want to administer a process. And then some of that's because they got, it was born out of HR, and we love process in HR. But, you know, talent acquisition isn't a process-led function. It's a sales kind of function that is activity-focused by nature. And yet, it's one of the reasons corporate talent acquisition fails so often. It's also another reason why there's organizations and companies like mine in the staffing world, which is a $500 billion business. And I try to tell people, the only thing my recruiters do differently than a corporate talent acquisition person is they pick up the phone. They actually call people. They actually go hunt for talent. They just don't post a job and pray and wait for somebody to apply. Mm-hmm. And but there's no reason why corporate talent acquisition couldn't act just like a staffing firm. We just somehow it hasn't ever gone that way. And I push back because I think it's mostly, you know, a staffing issue with the people that you choose. And again, then it gets back to the metrics and performance management and all those other great things that we do as leaders.
So I think that what I'm hearing, and I kind of am asking, you were talking a little bit about, you know, things when things are failing and, you know, that lack of ownership. But is there something, you know, other than picking up the phone and getting involved and really connecting with people that you see as helpful for companies to kind of get out of their own way and not fail?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's obviously there's chapter after chapter in the book, but it gets into employment branding, it gets into recruitment marketing, it gets into having the right technology and, you know, the right processes then in place. I mean, there are certain techniques and things that organizations do to attract talent. You know, think about Google, right? Like that's the unicorn, you know, when it comes to talent acquisition. Google posts a job and 1 million people apply because everybody wants to work at Google. And then your CEO comes back and says, well, we should be just like Google. And you're like, nah, don't ever do that. Like that's a failure recipe. They're a unicorn, right? They're an outlier, as Malcolm Gladwell would say. You have to say, okay, within our market, what's the goal? If I run a manufacturing company, you know, in the Midwest, can we be the best manufacturing company in our city, in our market, in our region? That's probably more doable. Now, again, then that comes into, okay, well, why? Why would someone come to work for you? What's the brand? Do you have great leadership? Do you have a great product? Do you have a great system? Do you have great compensation, great benefits? What are all those reasons that you have? And many times when I sit with a leadership team in a company, they'll look at me and say, well, what is it? What do you think? I can't answer that question, right? Like that is coming from you. And if you can't answer that question, you have a problem. And again, the way the world works now with, you know, the kind of the Yelpification of your employment brand, so people can go to Glassdoor and check out if you're being transparent or not. You know, you can't lie. You can't go, well, you know, we only hire the best talent because we have the best benefits with the best pay. And then everybody on Glassdoor is going, they're awful pay. It's awful benefits. The leadership team is awful. And so you can't lie anymore, but I don't ever ask companies to lie. There's a reason. You know, April, if you and I went to work at a company and by nature, we're positive people. We get involved. You know, we're the kinds of people that would go put the company logo tattoo, you know, somewhere on our body.
Yeah.
We're all in. When we decide we're in, we're all in. And I think every company has those people. Those are the people that you want to talk to. Those are the people that will tell you why it's a great place to work. And you might have people that think it's an awful place to work too. That's okay. I'm looking for the top end. There's people that find this a great place to work, and I want to find more people like them that think this is a great place to work. The classic example right now is Amazon, right? Amazon gets killed in the media for having this awful work environment, and yet they're the most successful company in the world. They're going to be the first $1 trillion company in the world. And what Amazon has done is to say, you know what? We're a hard place to work. If you come here to work, you're going to work your butt off, but you're going to be successful, and it's going to help your career, and we're going to put you on a path. But we only want people that are type A, that want to do that, that are willing to put the time and effort in. And if you're those people, you're going to love it here. If you're not, you're going to hate it here. This is going to be awful for you. And you're going to go on the Wall Street Journal and talk bad about us because, you know, you think we should be, you know, some, you know, you think we should be Google. We're not. We're not Google. We're Amazon. They're different, you know.
They're very different. Well, and I think when I'm thinking about what you're talking about in terms of acquisition with HR and helping people to identify those positive folks that you want to bring in and their contribution and what they can tell you about your workplace, makes me think a little bit about HR professionals who are also doing kind of so many roles at once, right? I mean, they're asked to juggle many roles at a time, not just, you know, taking care of benefits and like looking after, you know, policies and procedures and, you know, employee engagement surveys and follow up with plans, but also I think they're being asked more often than that to take on change management and helping companies, you know, go through a change. And, you know, for HR people who are HR folks in that field, you know, do you have any recommendations for how to kind of wear these multiple hats, or should they not wear multiple hats?
Well, you know, Sherman's kind of the preeminent kind of association, right, for HR. And they'll say themselves that probably 65% of their membership is what they call kind of an HR shop of one, which is that, hey, I have to do everything. I have to do payroll. I got to do employee relations. I got to recruit. I have to go and do executive leadership performance feedback. I have to, you know, you have to do everything. And I think that's one of the attractions to people when they come into HR, is because there is this ability to wear a lot of hats and do a lot of things, and the job is never boring. So I'm not going to tell them not to do that. We know in a world of specialization, you can find great efficiencies, right? So if you have the ability, you know, I always encourage people, you know, if they're really hurting in one area within their business, you know, hire a specialist instead of a generalist. Like a lot of times I find like HR shops of one, when they go to 2, 3, 4, 5 in terms of the numbers as the company grows, they'll go and just hire another generalist. Well, I just want another person who can wear a lot of hats because that's what we do, versus going, I'm going to go get a recruiter, and that recruiter is going to own all of recruiting, and I'm not going to have to worry about it. And that takes one less hat I can throw away and get rid of, versus going, you know, I talk to so many companies and I'll go, well, we have 5 of us on the team and we all have a little bit of recruiting, which gets back to that ownership thing of going, so basically you all hate recruiting and no one really wants to recruit. And so you fill your day with other things that you like doing from the talent attraction side. And it's no different. And I'm talking recruiting, but it's no different than any other part, right? Like you said, like HR is the catch-all. So all of a sudden now we want better culture. We want better employee engagement. We want change management. Oh, just throw it onto HR. And you have some poor person in HR who's spending 10% or 15% of their time trying to make an impact, knowing that somebody doing this 100% of the time would struggle. And so someone doing it 10 or 15% of the time is going to outright fail.
I think that I've seen that very often where everybody's trying to do, you know, a little bit of everything on that HR team as opposed to specializing. And it does, you know, as you said earlier, I mean, when everybody owns something, nobody owns it. And, I had a conversation with somebody recently about, you know, what's the difference between organizational development and change management, you know, and she was saying, well, I think they're the same thing. And I thought, wow, that is really interesting to, you know, just to not even be able to clarify what someone's role is in an organization, because you can't even figure out if there's a difference between OD and HR and change management.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I totally agree.
So in thinking about innovation in HR, what have you seen from other companies that I think, you know, Google and Amazon are innovative, but have you seen companies that maybe are not as leading edge, but still, you know, work some innovation into their team and be innovative in a different way?
Yeah, you know, I have a different concept of innovation than most people. So I think, you know, you hear so, especially within the HR kind of community or in leadership community, like, oh, well, what's the best practice, right? And then people assume best practice equals innovation. And I think best practice equals something somebody did 5 years ago that was innovative, and then it got proven out over time and time again, and now it becomes a best practice. So it was innovative 5 years ago. It's not innovative now. And so when we talk about innovation in the space around HR tech or TA tech or anything like that, it's really the smaller companies that probably come to play better. I wouldn't say necessarily that Google or Amazon or any big company is being innovative in the space. Most of what they're doing is already being done at the SMB level. You know, a great example, you know, that I heard the other day was, you know, a company that was struggling to get IT people. And, you know, and they were trying to do everything every big company was doing. They're putting postings up and they have a CRM and they're nurturing and, you know, employment branding and like everything possible they were doing, and they had the money to do it. And they finally, you know, decided like, we're going to personalize. We're going to get super personal with the candidate. So if I have a candidate, Tim Sackett's my candidate, I'm a recruiter, I'm going to get on my Apple, you know, my phone, and I'm going to do a short video right to Tim. Hey, Tim, this is Tom at ABC Company, and here we have this position, and I really want to talk to you about it. And here's why I think you're going to be great specifically for this. And the hiring manager said this about your resume. And like, again, less than a minute, and then texted them the actual video. And then the response rate's like 90% saying, yeah, I want to learn more. Where a normal response rate to like emails and stuff like that is around 7 or 10%. And again, people at a big company would go, well, we could never do that for 10,000 candidates. But if I have 5 candidates, that personalization really now pulls at the heartstrings of what I want. Like, I want a company to think I can help change them, that I can help make them better. And I think we're starting to see that personalization come out in branding and in candidate experience in a big way. And again, it's a simple thing that any company could do. You don't have to have a great technology platform. You don't have to have anything. You just have to have someone who's willing to say, what would I want, right? If I'm a candidate and I applied for this job, what would entice me to go, oh my gosh, I want to talk to that company, you know? And to me, it's personalization. I mean, imagine driving home tonight, April, and you're on the highway, same road you always go down, you and thousands of other people at 5 o'clock. And all of a sudden you see a billboard that says, April, we want to talk to you about this job. Call us tomorrow. Here's the number. Like, you literally would stop and take a picture because you'd be like, that's unheard of. And yet you could get a billboard for $500 a day, and you could actually do that every day as a company and probably make it cheaper and actually figure out, like, how do we know this person works here at a competitor and then they live here. So we know they probably drive this route. What if we went out and personalized and went after them in a very personal way? Some people would be put off by it. The vast majority would be so flattered, like, oh my gosh, They care that much about me that they're willing to do that. I know they want me. And we're all the same. We all just want to be wanted for what we can do.
That's such a cool idea. And the idea of, you know, making people feel wanted and special and not just as though, you know, you're a number coming through and you're one of many and they have their choice of everybody. And
you know, I always tell people recruiting is not difficult, right? It's not a hard thing, but it takes work. You know, I mean, that's the thing, you know, but like we've never, like right now I can get online and find almost any candidate that's out there because we all have a social footprint. So no time in the history of the world has it been easier to find talent. And yet most companies will come to me and say, we can't find talent. It's easy to find talent. It's hard to talk them into coming to work for you. That's the hard part. And that's the heavy lifting.
Yes. Yes. Wow. I love that. And I think, you know, you have so many cool ideas here in your book. I was reading through it. And what I really enjoyed was that you have so much dialogue. You just like have these little scenarios that you've written, you know, with dialogue between a hiring manager or a talent acquisition manager that's good versus great. That really tickled me, and I really enjoyed reading those pieces. I would highly recommend this book to everybody.
Thank you.
I think thinking about how we could apply this to change also, you know, we have so many HR professionals who are in some form of change in their organizations, and then you know, being able to kind of bring multiple ideas together, think through them, and then apply how they could benefit the company, how they could help those folks who are, you know, maybe generalizing in many ways, kind of get niched in and specialized either on talent and recruiting or on organizational development or on those leadership development classes you were talking about.
Well, just think about, I mean, the change management alone, just in HR and talent acquisition, I mean, those careers 3 years from now are going to be completely different. I mean, there's technology right now on the market that can replace probably 70% of what a recruiter does on a daily basis. That's totally automated. And within 3 years with artificial intelligence, it might be 90%. And so does that mean we're going to get rid of every recruiter and they're going to be replaced by quote unquote the robots? I don't think so. I think the position evolves, right? And that's part of change management is how do you evolve? And that's my pushback to the, you know, to the function right now. And I write a lot about it. It's like, what's the next generation? What's recruiter 2.0? What's sourcing 3.0? What's whatever? Like, what's the next job for you? Like, how does that change and look? And so, you know, April, you know this from your work, like so many people struggle to define that because they struggle just to be successful in their own job right now, let alone to define what am I going to be in 3 years and how is this going to go? And so they tend to just to kind of let it all pull them forward and they end up where they end up and the change happens to them. And that's the most stressful thing versus them actually going ahead and making the change and feeling empowered to do that. I mean, I think that's really, you know, the benefit of that.
Well, and I think you've nailed it because in those cases, you know, there is a very, there's a role that cannot be replaced, right? And it's the discernment piece cannot be replaced by artificial intelligence. Even great artificial intelligence like Watson can't necessarily discern between, you know, candidate A and candidate B based on some of those soft skill, interpersonal pieces that, you know, are very difficult to quantify and to measure.
Well, and I think in the relationship side, right, it's a human business, you know, I mean, it's people to people. And at the end of the day, you know, people are going to make decisions. But I always tell people, would you, if I texted you a message right now and it said, hey, April, it's whatever, you know, Tim, it could be anything, right? Because it's a robot. It wouldn't matter. Thanks for applying. You know, you answered some questions over text message. And now we want to offer you the job. And here's the salary. You would never accept that job, right? You would go, wait a minute, this isn't real. There's no possible way. Hey, show up Monday and we'll onboard you, you know?
We'll implant your onboarding chip.
And you're like, so again, there's networks and relationships and there's a people side of the business that eventually, you know, individuals want to, you know, connect with each other on that level. And that's where I think recruiting, for me, the new recruiting, you know, 2.0 actually becomes a little old school. It goes back to how do we nurture those networks and how do we actually build relationships with great talent? And I might not have an opening right now. And I just had this example where I knew a head of talent in a company in Ann Arbor, Michigan, tech company. They had a boomerang that wanted to come back from San Francisco. So somebody who lived in Michigan went out there to work and now they're like, you know, my family's there. And they don't have a position, but we will maintain a relationship with this person because they're so great. And eventually we hope we will have that position. And that's really the kind of the best way to, you know, that I can see kind of recruiting evolving, which becomes a little bit more high touch. But if you don't have to do any of that day-to-day tactical work because the technology is doing it, now you have time to build great relationships and find out who's really better than another. What is the best talent out there? My CEO says we hire the best talent, but we know we don't actually hire the best talent. We just hire the talent that actually applied at the time we had the opening and was willing to accept our average pay and benefits. That's not best talent. could be crappy talent. We don't know. So how do we go out and find actual better talent and then nurture those people to say, hey, when we do have an opening, we're going to pull the string and we want you to come work for us. And they're all in for it. They can't wait.
That's great. Tim, I have just a couple of speed questions for you here at the end. Do you have a tool, an online tool or an app or something that you use that you would recommend to people? Follow a lot to look at.
I use so many. I'm on LinkedIn all the time. So I'll say for all the frustration people have with LinkedIn, it's been an awesome tool for me to network. I can go out. In fact, I have a great story that I have three sons, two in college, and they needed internships. And so about 2 months ago, I literally put a small message, you know, hey, I have this son doing this. I have this son doing this. It takes a village. Come on, people, help me out. They need internships. And over 200,000 people viewed that. And I had literally hundreds respond with comments. And within a couple of weeks, they both had multiple offers from around the country.
Oh my gosh.
And so again, the power of your network, never underestimate what that can be. Now, again, I understand most people aren't going to spend, you know, every day on LinkedIn and building their network because that's not part of their job. It is for me. It's part of my career. So I kind of have to do it. people, my wife especially, thinks I'm online all day long, and because I'm everywhere, right? My stuff is being shared on LinkedIn, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and she's like, you know, what did you do today? And I'm like, oh, I was in meetings all day long. She's like, well, how are you on Facebook? And I'm like, I wasn't. I have everything set up in Hootsuite, and it makes me look like I'm everywhere at once without being everywhere at once. So
I love that. And do you have a book that you would recommend, something that you feel was influential to you in some way, or that you just think is a great book to recommend to others?
I read my own book on the plane last week when it got launched, because you write it a year ahead of time. And I was like, man, that's a really good book. No, I'm just the guy next
to me. I'll put a link to your book on the page too.
I have like the little, you have like the little picture on the back, and the guy next to me kept looking at me like, and you look at the picture and you look at me, and finally I'm like, yeah, I'm reading my own book. Sorry about that. No, I'm a huge fan of Malcolm Gladwell and his books, whether it's The Tipping Point or, you know, any of the ones that he has. Like, I just love not only how he kind of tells a story, wraps a story, you know, using data to really make the reader feel like there's no other option. Like this, oh my gosh, I have to do this today, you know. And I'm also kind of a living example of his 10,000 hours concept, right? Which is, hey, if you do anything for 10,000 hours, you become an expert. And in the writing, I didn't know if I could write. Even today, I'm not a very good grammatically, I wasn't an English major, so I don't have that kind of function around my writing. But just writing for 10 straight years, now I feel like I am a writer, I am an author, and obviously I got a book. And again, so it was that 10,000 hours of practice put into practice. And again, that's a concept that kind of, you know, Gladwell threw out there and kind of talked about and gave tons of examples. I'm a big fan of everything he writes. So
I agree. I really love Malcolm Gladwell. I remember reading Blink and feeling like my head had kind of exploded just from wow, I'm a changed person. So that's a great, those are great books to recommend. So we will definitely put a link to those as well.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Tim, for the information and for talking on the Change and Innovation Summit. I really enjoy talking with you. And of course, you know, I'm thrilled about your success and your new book and all the projects and blogs and conferences that you're attending. It's fantastic.
Excellent. Thanks, April.
Take care.